Reichman University.
Beyond the Uniform. Stories of strength, resilience, and rising to the occasion. With Rachel Safty and Rachel Iskandry.
Hey, it's Rachel Safty.
And Rachel Iskandry.
And welcome to the Beyond the Uniform podcast on Audioversity, where we tell you the untold stories of the heroes of Israel.
Today, we have a special guest that was born and raised in Arizona and moved to Israel alone to join a special unit in the Border Police.
Little did he know that he would be one of the first people to see combat on the 7th of October. Cameron, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to explain my story and teach people a little bit about the Army and my story.
Of course, amazing. So maybe start by telling us a little bit about where you grew up, where you're from.
Yeah, of course. So I'm my name's Cameron Weinberg. I was born in Mesa, Arizona, just a small town right outside of Phoenix, you know, in the middle of the desert. I was 24 years old. And no, from there, I've always had an interest in Israel, obviously. It was never my first plan to move here. As most like American boys, my first dream was playing the NFL. So obviously, I grew up my whole life. My dad was a high school football coach, so I loved football. You know, I played a few different positions, but I realized, you know, genetically I wasn't blessed.
Wasn't for you.
Yeah, you know, I'm decently sized. I'm 6 foot, but I'm only like 180 pounds, so I'm not too big. But,
in the next life.
Yeah, so I actually, in high school, I learned to a new position. I was a kicker, and from there, I actually got a college scholarship to play football in the University of Arizona. It's about 2 hours from my house. I thought it was perfect. You know, it's a little outside of my house. It's 2 hours away, but it's not too close. I can still visit my family on the weekends, but I'm not living at home. Mm-hmm. So that was a perfect plan. And of course, like many people, coronavirus happened. And that really threw a lot of things off. You know, it canceled the season. There was a lot of budget cuts to the programs. I want to say depression, but there's a lot of people, you know, it was not the greatest times. You know, a lot of people were
mentally.
Yeah, a lot of people were at home by themselves. You had more time to yourself, more time to think about what you really wanted in life. And during this time, I really didn't know when football was going to start up again, and that was really a big purpose of me being in college. So my grades dropped a little bit, you know, as a lot of people did, and I really thought about what I wanted.
So you were already in university?
Yeah, so I was. I didn't make my decision until the second semester, so I was second semester in the freshman year. Mm-hmm. And basically near the end of the semester, I dropped out, and that's when I started my process of joining Green Sabah.
Where did that, like, motivation and inspiration to move to Israel come from?
So, yeah, funny thing, I'd actually, my family used to visit Israel almost every year, and I never went because of sports. I always had, obviously, in the summer, it's a big time for football.
Mm-hmm. Training.
So I was never, I was never really able to go, sadly, but, you know, I'm here now. I made up for it. but, I was always interested in college. I never really thought about the Army-wise, though. I always wanted to visit. But in college, I obviously was a... I want to say huge part, but I went to Hillel, I went to Chabad, I did a few of the Jewish things on campus, and that's where I met a few Israelis and a few lone soldiers that had gotten out of the Army and were now studying at the University of Arizona. And, you know, I learned a little bit about their story, a little about what they did, and, you know, it was really, really interesting to me because it was during Corona that I really thought about, like, opening a new chapter in my life and kind of changing directions. Mm-hmm. And so they really introduced me into like a different side to the world, I guess, something that I never explored before and something that I guess I really looked into and found out that something that I really wanted to do.
How did your parents take it? You know, you're already almost finishing your first year.
And you didn't tell them until I had everything done.
Oh, you were like breaking news.
I waited probably until like, this was all during COVID, so I didn't really know when my flight was. So once I got everything in, it was basically one of those things that you needed to, I had to wait till the airport was open and all these different things. Mm. So it took me longer than normal to get everything done. And that's when I kind of told my parents, you know, maybe I'll do taglit. You know, I was like birthright to like kind of introduce them into it. And then a few weeks later, I was like, you know what? Maybe I'm going to move there for the summer. I never said anything about the Army because I know they would be a little bit nervous about it. So I kind of like eased them into it. And I didn't tell them about the Army until after I moved here. Mm-hmm. So basically, I told them that I was going to do Green Sabah, which is, they don't really know anything about it, which is like a summer program in Israel, and see how much I like it. And if I hated it, could always come back, and if not, I could stay in Israel.
So that's kind of how introduced it to them. Rachel, also, you also joined.
I was in Garin Tzabar in August 2021. I got to Israel.
Highly recommended.
It's an amazing program. It's basically a program, an international one under Tzofim, which is also like the Israeli scouts that's international. And it helps lone soldiers, future lone soldiers from around the world, so many different countries, come to Israel, make aliyah, and they assign you to a specific kibbutz or moshav, and you live there with people from the same region, and they help you do like your initiation process and learn Hebrew and learn about the country. And it's an amazing, amazing program that like really gives you a soft landing. I loved my experience. And I'm really happy to hear that you enjoyed yours too.
I got super lucky. I was actually, most people end up on kibbutzim on the borders, kind of, you know, everyone wants to be in Tel Aviv. So they kind of put you.
Are there?
I got Ranana. I was in Ranana. Wow. So I was in the Ben-Lumi, which is like the international Gurin. Mm-hmm. So I was with people from all different countries. It was like a quarter American, quarter European, quarter on a people from South Africa, and then a quarter.
Yeah, like, I think they call you guys the international, like, Gurin.
So we're with a little bit of everyone, and we're lucky that Gurin always goes to Ranana. Mm. So I kind of knew I was going to Ranana, which was an amazing experience because I was 20-30 minutes from Tel Aviv. We're not kind of in the middle of nowhere.
So how did you go from being in university, learning about Israel and the possibility of even moving from some people that were there, to figuring out what this program Garin Tzabar is, to really deciding, you know, how's that process? You contact them and then you start meeting people, and how does that work?
Yeah, so I first started out by contacting the Jewish agency. Mm. And then through there I contacted some from Garin Tzabar. And, you know, they really walk you through the process. My process was very special because it was during COVID. So it was very hectic, very different. And I'll give you a funny Aliyah story. One of my roommate, one of my best friends, we actually, to tell you how much of little work we actually did to make Aliyah, we actually flew over here and we lied to them because in order to get on this flight, you had to have a place to live, plans and everything. And we had to write down an entire story about how we have a Airbnb in Tel Aviv, and we're doing Garin Tzabar. When I flew over, I wasn't in Garin Tzabar. I didn't have anywhere to live. I just thought to myself, I'm going to figure out when I'm in the COVID hotel. I'm going to have 10 days of myself and figure it out.
You're like, I don't care what happens. I'm coming.
So we lied on everything. We came here with nothing. Had no money, like no nothing. Well, I had a little bit of money, but not enough to stay for a long time without a job.
Right.
But I basically, I lied to him about everything. I got to the COVID hotel, and I don't know anyone. It's like, I don't know anyone in Israel.
You didn't have any family
I have no
here.
Family. I used to have some cousins. They moved back to America before I made Aliyah. So I knew no one, had no friends, nothing. And I go out on my porch, and I see this guy, you know, around my age. And I start talking to him, and I realize he did the same thing. He has nowhere to live. He has no job. He wants to do Garin Tzabar as well. He wants to do the army.
You both just needed to.
Half the people weren't working. Half people don't answer. And everything's just, as you can say, like a belagan. You could say it's like a big mess.
Right.
So we basically figured it out from inside of Israel, very last minute and very hectically.
Wow. Wait, so, that's like quite the Zionism you guys are showing here. This is incredible.
Yeah. So it's a great story. I always, something that we always laugh about, how, you know, stupid kid stuff, but, and then it all worked out.
So tell us a bit about your experience living with all these international Jewish people that came here also to draft, and how was the whole process of figuring out where in the army you want to draft, to go into combat, to not, to choose a unit?
No, it was amazing. I mean, I loved, I've always lived in America. All my friends have always been American. So I loved being in the international Garin. It like really opens up your mindset. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing now because now when I want to travel, I have a house in all these different countries I can stay for free. So that's a big
benefit.
Like,
let me tell you the real reason.
Yeah. So if anyone wants to travel, do the international grouping. You get free hotels.
Oh, my God.
But no, I loved it. I think it was the best. It really opened up my mind and really gave me a new perspective on the world. And no, my best friends, like to this day, 4 or 5 years later, are still people from my grouping. We still live together. Yeah. Everyone, we're basically neighbors. We all live within 100 meters of each other. So I think it's like the best family that I have. Still
it's
in
incredible.
Israel.
My roommates are also Garin Tzabar, like my Garin, and I love them. I will be at their wedding. They'll be at mine. It's an incredible experience.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys actively, you move to Israel and you find
you don't know them that well. Yeah, like they just assign you to a group and they're like, okay, everyone get along now.
This is your family.
Yeah.
And it's always the best because you see them on Zoom for like a month.
Yeah.
You don't really know who they are. You kind of see them. You know what they kind of look like. And then you meet them finally in person.
And you're like, you're not what I thought you were.
The first time you meet them, you're moving in with them. It's not like you're meeting them as
no, there's
for
no
a few
prep.
Hours. You just move. You literally move in with them like a college dorm almost.
I think they do it a little differently now that it's not COVID. But but yeah, they're like, here you go, guys. 20, 18-year-olds. Enjoy yourselves.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Wait, wow, so how did you then get to Border Police? Like, Green Sabah drafting, what's the journey?
So, really, in Green Sabah, it's through the Army, so they mostly talk about the Army. So I always knew, for me, I always wanted combat, so it was an easy decision. I have a lot of friends that it was very hard for them because they didn't know if they want to do a good job in Modi'in, like intelligence, or they want to do combat, which one they felt like would contribute more to the country. Because, you know, just being combat doesn't... For my personal opinion, I think all jobs are important, not just combat.
There are so many jobs in the Army that are
combat, but
so many that are not even heard of. Like even when you're in the Army, you have no idea what
even
half
for
the
my
are.
Job in the Border Police. If I don't have three other people in different jobs, I can't do my job, or I can do my job but more dangerous and less effective. So almost every job is very important. So it's a big decision deciding on where you want to contribute, even to like any job contributes. I think.
I love the way you put that, where you want to contribute.
Yeah, to the max, as long as you work your hardest. So from there, I really didn't know anything about the Border Police. They mostly talk about the Army. The Border Police is kind of, you know, you see them in Jerusalem. You don't really talk about what they do. And you kind of know, like, oh, they have the gray uniforms. They have the cool uniforms. They have, like a lot of people say, like, they have a lot of, like, wasakh. They have a lot of, like...
They're cool. They're cool, badass.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you have also like you know the stereotype like the Aksim, like kind of how would you say that?
Wow, that's a hard one.
I don't know how to translate
Anyone who knows, you know what I'm talking
it's
about.
It's a very specific type of people that go there. It's it's important to note also for our listeners that the Border
they're
amazing people.
Yeah,
that the Border Police is a separate body from the Army. They're also under the Ministry of Defense, right?
Yes.
Right, yeah, but they're not considered
not the Army.
We're considered under the police.
Under police.
We're our own thing, but we're under the regular kind of police, and then we're all
it's
like...
It's defense. It's just a different entity of defense.
You're almost... I always call it like an but you're a do-it-all person. You're half Army, half police. You can do both.
So, everything is you.
Yeah.
And you're located mostly around Jerusalem?
So most Border Police is... obviously going to be in a lot on the borders, but when you think of borders in Israel, there's if you really look at a map, there's borders everywhere. There's borders all over the West Bank. There's borders all over Jerusalem. We're really, I would say the difference is the Army is going to be for fighting outside the borders, and anything inside of Israel is going to be Border Police, as you would say.
Right.
So anything that you look at on a map inside of Israel, most of it's going to be controlled by the Border Police.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So how was the beginning of that, the process of getting into it?
So I'll give a little story. My my dream, obviously, because a lot of Americans, I wanted to be in Shayatit, which is like the Navy SEALs. You know, all the people you see in the movies, you're like, that's what I want to be. I want to be in the water. I want to be doing secret missions and, you know, everything like that. So during Green Sabah, afterwards you go to Mechvelon, which is the base for learning
Rachel
Hebrew.
Has some funny stories.
We could talk probably for days about Mechvelon. Probably
one
of the funniest places you can be. You're going to meet amazing people. You're going to meet not so great people. You're going to, you know, that's going to be really your introduction to the Army. But for my story, from there, I did inside of that program, I did Gibush Shayatit because that was my dream. So in the middle of Gibush Shayatit, I actually...
Explain to our listeners what Gibush is.
Yeah, Gibush is basically a tryout. So most Gibushim are 3 to 5 days of just intense evaluation, workouts, mental tests, different things. And you have people there that are basically on a clipboard evaluating how you do, if you're fit for the unit, if you're not fit for the unit.
Also, if you're not fit, it opens doors up for like other jobs,
they also
right?
There's also if it's something you call fall down. So when you do a tryout for Shayate, which is like the top of the
elite
top.
Elite unit.
You still have commando, you have the serot, you still have different things that you can go downwards to. And they're not really down. I mean, they just
They're still amazing units.
Yeah. They're not down at all.
Yeah, it's just in the hierarchy of things, that's just kind of how they say it.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like scouting, correct?
Yeah, but
me
you
if
always
I'm wrong.
Start with the at the very top, obviously. So you're going to the tryouts start from the top and then you kind of go down from there. So in the middle of this tryout, I actually dislocated my ankle. So anyone that's injured, no matter how good you are, because I thought I was pretty good. personally. obviously, you're not going to pass. So
you can't.
You should go to the hospital.
Yeah, so from there, I was basically in recovery for 2 to 3 months.
Oh, wow.
And during this time, because most of my green, obviously, after the tryouts, you're going to go to your army unit. So for me, I was, my profile was like one of the lowest ones because I couldn't walk. I was basically in crutches for 3 to 4 months.
Wow. So and without a high profile, you can't be a combat soldier because
exactly.
That's the evaluation.
But it was a temporary thing. It was just until I got my leg reevaluated.
Okay.
So eventually
profile,
I went
back. Wait, sorry, I have to mention this because I didn't know what this was either before I got to Israel, that a profile in the army is a number given to you based off of your physical capability. So let's say like I have bad eyesight, I wear contacts every day, and my profile was lowered from the highest one to a little bit lower, and then it depends based off of your different like medical issues and stuff like that.
Exactly. I actually had the highest profile, and but because I'm a woman, I didn't have to go into combat. And I know a lot of men that have the highest profile, which is 97. They have to go a lot of times to combat units because the army needs.
Yeah, like it's definitely
yeah
a necessity.
Yeah. I'll give another really quick story, but because I made Aliyah. Because I moved to Israel, they don't have my medical records because I do have asthma and everything. I would not have got the highest profile, but
oh
I lied to them.
Oh, my God.
So I end up, to this day, hopefully no one sees this. I do have the highest profile, but I really shouldn't.
Your determination to be in combat is incredible.
I know. And I want to say it's really, really beautiful seeing a person like you that is flying into Israel, lying in the application about having a place to go, you know, wanting so hard to be in a combat unit to give the most of yourself, because there's so many people today, a lot of Israelis that are trying to get out mm-hmm. of combat units. I know so people, true. You know, that are trying to lower their profiles mm-hmm. because, you know, of course I want to contribute, I'll go to intelligence, but I don't want to go fight in a war. And you did everything you can to go fight in the war. So really, I mean, congratulations. And it's amazing to see
this. Incredible.
These are really the amazing heroes of Israel. So thank you.
I was really inspired. There's so many different stories of lone soldiers before me that did even crazier things. Mm-hmm. So I was really inspired. I knew like if they can get what they did done, then I can obviously do what I want to do and keep my story going as I want it.
So, amazing. Yeah. So then you got your reevaluation and you were okay.
Yeah. So basically for a few months I was like in the air. I didn't really do anything. I was like in the army, but not because basically in recovery. I tried to recover as well as possible. And during this time, I actually had a friend in a special unit in Magav called Yamas. I've never heard of it. Magav is border police, and Yamas is a special unit inside of this border police. It's kind of like their highest tier unit.
Their elite unit.
Their
elite
reconnaissance unit.
Yeah,
of
inside of the border police. And I never heard of it. I knew nothing about it. And I had a friend in that unit that had just got out of the army, and he told me, look, you want the Shayatit, you want the commando, but do you want to close on base? You want to do all these hard 100-kilometer marches?
Oh, wow.
Do you want to do, you know, Kav, which is where you sit on the border and just kind of look through a telescope, at least before the war? Or do you want a unit that, you know, you go home on Thursdays, there's no Shmira, which is like, would you say Shmira is like
guard duty? Where it's just
hours. So. You get a lot of wasach because you get your pistols. You get pistols. So that's one of the special things about the unit that people really
like. That people really like. You know.
So there's all these benefits, and then he's like, but
do
all you do is
two
missions.
Guns, though? Do you get a pistol and what? An
so
M4,
basically,
an M16?
On base, I'd had two guns. I had sometimes three, depending on the day. I had my M4, which is my regular like long rifle, and then I always had my pistol. So when I went home, we go home in civilian clothes. I never wore a uniform. So even on base, I walked around basically for the most part in sport shorts.
That's because you went home in civilian clothes because you were in the elite unit inside Border Patrol?
Yeah. Okay. So the kind of like the point of the unit is this is a lot of undercover work. So they treat us mostly as undercover police. So we mostly will go around in civilian clothing with a pistol that obviously is like under our shirt and no one can see.
Yeah, it's for and security purposes.
Yeah, not so that's to, the big point of the unit. So it's like a... There's a lot of upsides to the unit. I'm so happy I went there. I think it's the best unit. I give it all the praise.
Amazing.
But it's basically like an elite unit, but you have a lot of, I'll introduce another word, Tosh. It's probably the highest Tosh you can get.
Tosh. Tosh is
Tosh is like the...
Tosh is amazing.
I would say it's the quality of life. It encompasses
that's a great
a lot
way
of
to put it, the quality of life.
So
it's how much time you get for yourself, exactly. Where you're not in training. It's how much time you get at home instead of closing full weekends
the
on
benefits.
Base. Benefits. Yeah.
How good your rooms look like in the army, how good your food is.
There's a difference between army budget and police budget. Mm-hmm. It's a big difference. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more money and a lot less people in the police. So when you get a lot of
they allocate
stuff.
The funds differently.
Exactly. Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so... You got to the elite unit?
So basically, to get there, it's a little different. So most units, you do the gibush/tryout before you go to tirunut, which is basic training. This is the opposite. So it's a little scarier because you don't know what's really going to happen. Because so basically, I went to Magav, which is the border police. I did the basic training. At the end of basic training, then you do the trial. And this trial is a lot different than Shayat did because in like the Navy SEALs and stuff, you're still civilian. They have rules. They can't. You're not a soldier. You're not in the army. There's a lot of rules that to follow. And now in this trial, you're no longer you're a soldier. They can do anything they want to you. You have 5 days of I would consider
prove
the hardest.
Yourself.
Some people say no. Some people say yes. I would say it's definitely, on my opinion, from what I've seen, the hardest tryout.
Wow.
Because you're this one. You I mean, there's shooting involved. There's a lot of things that you can't do in the other trial just because
it's
now,
also after your training.
You're
expecting...
a full-on soldier. This isn't the beginning. This is the end of your training. This is you're a full-on supposed to be border police, policeman already. So after this, I passed. And then from there, obviously, I did another year of training. And then from there, I
started. A whole year of training?
We actually have a pretty short training compared to the other
a year is short.
yeah
wow
so how much time in total were you in your service in your
So I drafted at the age of 22, so I only did 2 years. Most people do 2 years 8 months. I only did 2 years just because of my age.
The older you are, for viewers listening,
I was in the unit a relatively short time. By the time I finished training, I was only there for about a year. But, I mean, half that time was during the war, so it was a pretty, I felt like it was a long service, but it really wasn't. It was shorter than most people's, but, you know, I still have reserve duty and everything, so I get to go back here and there, so.
Amazing. Yeah. So how was life, as a border police in Yamas, in the elite unit of the border police, before the war? What was your day-to-day?
Yeah,
what did you do?
I'll definitely talk about this. So I was in, there's different zones or sectors of each unit. So I was assigned to the unit of the South, which is basically from Jerusalem down, just like almost half the country. So
yeah,
we're very mobile. We go a little bit of everywhere. We kind of help out a little bit everywhere, but day to day.
Also in the border with Gaza?
Yeah, so our main task is the border with Egypt and Gaza. That's going to be our main job. And then we're also going to help out a little bit in the West Bank, a little bit here and there, basically wherever they need us. But our if there's anything going on in the borders, that's going to be our Gizra, like our area.
Yeah, your assigned region.
Yeah. So day to day, it was mostly, you know, you're doing a lot of arrests. There's a lot of drug smuggling. There's a lot of ISIS presence on the side of Egypt that you know, like to drive up in trucks and shoot at our soldiers on the border. Wow. And then also you have the riots on Gaza, which is a big thing that we get, that our unit that specializes in. So we're a pretty big unit in special weapons and everything that have to do with the border of Gaza with
the
riots.
You fought ISIS in Egypt?
No, not inside of Egypt. But
no,
they,
of course not inside
they,
of Egypt, but through.
Come, yeah, they come to the border. They try to throw. That's where a lot of weapon smuggling and a lot of drugs right. is in wow. there. A lot of like ISIS-affiliated or people there. So it's a pretty... It is... People think of it as a quiet area, but it really is day-to-day. It can be pretty crazy there.
Wow.
So, I mean, I'm sure people know. I mean, there's been... Before the war, I think there was like 3 or 4 deaths on the border right there. So, yeah.
There's definitely deaths of soldiers.
Of soldiers, yeah.
Yeah, of soldiers that died like on duty.
Yeah.
At the border.
That's horrible. And a lot of people don't know this, actually. I think they forget about, you know, prior to October 7th, as you said, there was riots on the Gaza border every day.
3 to 4 months before, there were riots almost every day.
And that's one other reason probably that, you know, we... maybe didn't expect October 7th because it was a normal thing seeing, you know, so many people coming up close to the border.
It was one of those things where the first month, you know, it's in the news and then you get tired of it. You know, you see the same thing on the news every day and the cycle moves on. People move on from it and that's kind of...
It's nothing new.
Maybe one of the things that contribute to it, I'm not sure, but it was happening for a while.
For a few months.
Yeah.
So how was, you know, you said you were one of the first people to see combat that day. To describe us
I'll give a little bit of backstory. So obviously in my unit or one of our areas is going to be the Gaza border. So our job basically, to shorten it up, is to make sure there's no, as we call it, infiltrations from the fence. So our job is basically to prevent anyone from Gaza from crossing the fence and doing terrorist attacks inside of Israel. So we're there for, you know, every time there's a riot, for the most part we're going to be there. And for a few months.
Not in Gaza?
Not
but
in Gaza.
In the Israeli part of the border.
On the Israeli part of the border. And we have, you know, we have a lot of different ways of dealing with the riots. But mostly we're in like armored cars called a Zev, which means wolf. Which is like a little, it's like an armored car that you can basically drive up and down the border safely. And I remember the first time that someone threw like a Molotov cocktail in our car, just catch on fire. I remember like. There's a lot of crazy, I have videos of everything, it's crazy, crazy moments.
Oh, wow.
What?
Yeah. Because during this time, there's a lot of rules, obviously, because, you know, Israel, Gaza is a very sensitive subject. So we're under very intense rules because we don't want to inflame the conflict. So for the most part, they're, you know, allowed to do a lot of things to us. As long as no one's injured, we kind of let it go. As long as no one's crossing the border. And
which is like, the opposite of what happens today and of what the media would say, you know, because back in the day, it's always Israel soldiers are inciting violence.
I remember a few times where literally people would shoot at us. We'd shoot back and I would see the next day on the news like Israeli soldier kills innocent Palestinian. I remember seeing that in like the BBC and stuff.
It's
and I was
so
like,
insane
I was there.
What the narrative
like,
is.
It's crazy, yeah. So, but wow. You know, that's... A lot of people aren't very happy with Israel now, and that's the narrative they're going to pick. So,
of course, unfortunately.
We can only do our job to fight misinformation.
And to share the truth, which is...
Of course.
Thank you for being here, which is what you're doing.
Yeah.
So tell us about that terrible day.
Yeah, of course. So where do I start? So the weekends, during the entire week, obviously, the few months prior, they're having riots. So it's... kind of our daily routine. We know when we go to base, we know, okay, first thing we're going to do, we're going to get ready. We're going to get everything ready for mostly for riots. So that's like our day-to-day routine. We're going to be there. We're going to have Akbat Sot all the time, which are jumping. We would jump to the area quickly, meaning we could get a call.
Getting called quickly.
We have like 1 minute to get ready. You know, it's like a firefighter. Everyone gets their gear on and you drive like 100 kilometers an hour to wherever they need to. You know, and you kind of get into a routine of this and you don't really expect anything to change because the same thing happens every day and you get very like stagnant. So no one's thinking of, oh, what if one day everyone just tries to run across the border? Because it's nothing that's never happened. We feel like we're ready if that does happen, but it's just not something that comes across anyone's mind.
Everyone thought
that nobody expected the worst to happen.
Of course, of course. I mean, we're ready for everything, obviously. But it's not something that was... It was nothing that I really personally thought about. I don't know about other people. I can only really speak for myself. It's not something that I really ever thought about. But basically, the weekend prior to was, sadly, my weekend to close. So I wasn't very happy about it. So obviously, on Thursday, we go over to Kibbutz Nachaoz, which is one of the kibbutzim that is like our area.
One of the villages.
It's the village that's closest to the Gaza border, so it's one of our main. There's also an army base there, and it's one of our main areas that we want to protect because it's obviously if someone runs across the border, it's gonna be the first place they get
right,
to.
Right, the proximity is
it's
so
only
close.
It's only 500-600 meters. From the border.
So you're there to protect the civilians that live 500-600 meters from the Gaza border.
Exactly.
And so they're telling you have to spend the weekend there to protect the civilians in case something happens.
Yeah, exactly. So we're there. We're also there because it's kind of a meeting point so that we can get to any area along the strip relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, because we're not that big of a unit. It's a pretty small unit. So we need to be in a relatively middle area and able to get to anywhere we need to on the time that we need to. Mm-hmm. Obviously everything's been planned out, like how long it's going to take us to get to every area, so everything's kind of planned out, so we kind of know what to do. Basically on that weekend, so Friday comes, they have riots every day, and Friday comes and it's quiet. So the first like Shabbat that it's pretty quiet Friday night, and we're happy because usually Friday night they do riots pretty late, so we don't have Shabbat. We can't have Shabbat. So usually Friday is kind of a sucky day because, yeah, they know they want to have Shabbat. Let's just keep them busy until 10 o'clock at night. And then by the time they get back and, you know, it's already midnight, they just want to go to sleep. So it kind of ruins your Shabbat. So this is the first Shabbat, you know, we had a lot of fun. We're kind of almost celebrating. I would say we're celebrating. We're happy because, you know, nothing really happened. It's getting quieter.
Did that raise any flags? Like, did you guys think this is strange, or was it just thank God that nothing is happening?
No, because I can only speak for myself personally. I didn't think of anything. I thought, you know, after 3-4 months, one day off isn't, you know, if it was a week off, maybe I would have thought of something, but one day off, I didn't think anything.
No, like strange signs.
I didn't think anything too weird of it, like too anything weird like that. But you know, we come back, we have a nice Shabbat dinner, we kind of stay up, you know, we're up until like midnight, 1 a.m. we're celebrating, we finally have Shabbat, how fun it is to, you know, be together as a seven, as like a team. So yeah, and then we go to bed around midnight, and
in
then,
the army base
in an area close to it. I don't know if I'm really allowed to. I can't really say exactly where, but an area very close to, very close to army base. Basically, near the kibbutz, near the village. Because the army, we're not really part of the army, so the army's kind of their job about the army base, and then we're kind of our own. We're kind of separate from them.
You're in charge of protecting civilians.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, we go to bed, and I wake up on my shmira on about 6 o'clock. And so I wake up 6 o'clock, you know, I'm tired. No one likes to do guard duty at 6 a.m. It's one of the worst ones.
Especially not on a Saturday.
Yeah, you know, it's the sun's starting to come up and, you know, you're kind of sitting there. It's hot. It's not the summer, but it's still hot, humid from the, you know, it's the beginning of October. So it's the end of summer and, you know, I'm sitting there.
How many hours was your guard duty supposed to be?
No, just about an hour. Just an hour long. It's not too bad. You know, it's worse.
There's worse.
Definitely worse. I've done more. I've done longer. But then at about, 6:29, there's rocket alarms. And you're like, okay, you don't think of anything about it. We've been in Gaza. We're so used to it. Like, happens all the time that there's a random alarm. So you don't even think about it. So obviously everyone gets up and we don't really have a mamad, like a protected place, but we have a place that we go during the alarms.
Wait, and so you left your guard duty point to go
It's like 5 meters away. It's not,
it's not a...
Not that I'm like going anywhere. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So after like 1 to 2 minutes, we realize, wow, this is like, you're hearing like, really big explosions that you're not used to. It's like, wow, it's like landing. But we can't really tell. We're like, it's like literally landing on top of us. That's when we start to like look out the door and everything. And we're like, yeah, there's like 1,000 rockets in there. What the hell is going on? Something happened. That's all we understood.
So already before 7 o'clock, you guys are like, this isn't normal. Like something's off.
Yeah. Like right away within the first few minutes, just based off the rockets.
The intensity.
I was here during the last war, like in 2021, I was like right when I made Aliyah, and I'd never seen anything like this. This is like 1,000 rockets in like 5 seconds. And it's like, usually, you know, Iron Dome's super loud, but it's not like, I don't even know how to say, if you've ever been next to like a giant speaker in a concert and you like hits a bass, you it's like feel, boom. It's like,
yeah, but
it's
you like can feel constant. The sound.
Yeah, you can like feel it in your heart.
I mean,
like,
in May of 2021, a rocket fell maybe a few kilometers from me, and I felt as if it's like 10 yeah. meters from me. So yeah. I can't even imagine, you know, what you felt being yeah. so close to Gaza.
And we also realized that something goes off just based off of what's going on in the. On the radio and everything going on with the radio, we're like, okay, something's off and no one knows what's happening. No one, like, everyone's kind of like still trying to figure everything out. So as a precaution, we obviously get ready for the worst. That's what you should always do, what all soldiers usually do. You're gonna get ready for the worst. So first thing we do is we go to our like area where we get ready, we put on all our gear, blah blah blah, and from there we kind of try to figure out. We do like our own situational assessment. We try to figure out what's going on. And at this point, it's probably like 6:40. And at that time, we get on the radio saying that terrorists have like infiltrated from wow. Gaza. We don't know anything more. Basically, it was just like a quick sentence and that's it. So at that point, we kind of knew, okay, this is like the day that we're, I want to say ready for, but this is like the day we've been training for. Like, you know, there's two to three terrorists that came through the border that are trying to
you thought it was two to three terrorists. That because yeah. that's already
imaginable.
That's huge.
Before that's yeah. insane, because we all thought that, you know, that is an unbreakable fence, unbreakable yeah. border. Wow. Okay, yeah. so how were you feeling then?
You know, I won't want to say excited, because it's like not a good situation, but it's, you know, When you train all day for something and then that final, it's almost like a sports. Like finally, it's like game day. You finally get a, you know, you think, okay, this is like the time to like really perform and do your job. It's like you get like a nervous excitement. Like you're very nervous because you know how
adrenaline.
Real it is. Yeah, you know like how real it is. Like, you know, like at this moment, like it could be your last. But you know like why you're doing it. This is what you worked for the past year and a half. And you try, like this team is like your family. You trust everyone. You know everyone.
And you have a job to protect the civilians
exactly.
that are there.
Exactly. And you know, like, you're, not that you're by yourself, but, like, this is your area, and this is, like, you need to do your job no matter what.
Protect it.
Yeah, of course. So at that point, we just, you know, we do, I can't go into too much, but we do what we need to do just based off the intelligence that we have, and until we realize, you know, after, like, 10, 15 minutes, we realize, like, wow, we can like see, we're 500 meters from the kibbutz, and there's like a little dirt hill that kind of protects you from snipers. That can make you show how close you are to the border, that there's literally a dirt hill on the border of the kibbutz to make sure that people don't snipe you from a house in Gaza.
Wow.
I mean, that's how close you are. And we realized from there that there's thousands of rockets, and the Iron Dome's not shooting all of them down. We can see trucks. You can see mostly from where we are, the entire Gaza Strip, and you see thousands of people just running in trucks. You can see everything, and you're like, no way this is real. It's like a dream. It's like, no way, like, it's fake. There's no way. It's like a joke. The army's playing a joke. Like,
are you so, like comprehending, or are you guys looking
no, really,
at each other like, what
for
is
me personally, like, I couldn't, like, I was like, this is crazy.
I'm sleeping. I'm
yeah, yeah,
there's no,
like,
way.
This
there's
isn't
no
real.
Way this isn't real.
Oh my god.
Yeah, so at that point we basically we have kind of our predetermined plans of what we need to do. So we're a very small group. We're only about 11, 12 people, plus a few of the security forces inside of the kibbutz or inside of the village. So we know, I mean, we're only about 14 people, which really isn't that.
And
that
you see many hundreds running.
We see hundreds towards us, but we see thousands in total, because we can see, you can see, you know, 3 to 4 kilometers south, 3 to 4 kilometers north. You can see wow. almost everything, and you're like, holy crap, what? But then at the end of the day, you also think, like, this is Israel. Like, we're going to have the Air Force. We're going to have everyone coming. It's okay. All we have to do is protect
them. Hold them off.
Hold them
for
2-3 minutes and we'll be okay. Like, it's not, it's a big deal, but it's, we'll be okay. Excuse me. And from there, we go to basically where we need to go in order to, our pre-planned areas for where we need to go to protect the village. And after a few minutes, you know, I mean, you know they're coming, and you can't really see them because, like I said, you have this dirt hill. So we knew if you go beyond the dirt hill, you're in the open, you're kind of screwed. You obviously, you can't be on that. You need to be on the other side. So we're waiting, and then, like, boom. It just, like, hits, like, hundreds of people. You can see, like, literally
wow.
people. There's so many people. There's people literally without guns. People that just have bags full of ammo and grenades, because there's so many people.
I mean, yeah, we know now that it was also civilians that took part in
it.
People just running in
people
to
just
take money.
In. Crazy. It's crazy. And you're like, holy crap. It's like a point where
you can't train for something like this. Like, it's like, it's, it goes to all instincts. There's no plan. Like, at that point, there's, your plan goes away.
Cause your heart drops, probably.
Yeah. And you're like, okay, well, this is the lot. This is it. Like, this is like one of those things where you're like, all right, we're like screwed, but we're going to like, you're going to fight as hard as you can. But it's like, not that you lose hope, but you're kind of like.
Did you, you feared for your life?
Honestly, no. Cause it was like, you, I couldn't comprehend it. I was never, until afterwards, I was never scared because I kind of like. Adrenaline. Accepted it. You it's like accepted fight or it because it's yeah, think. It's not like, you know, your team versus another 10 people. Like when you see like tons and tons, like 100 people, you're like, okay, like this is like what God wanted. This is God, like what can I do? Like you're gonna fight as hard as you can, but wow. You don't even like comprehend it at that point. So basically, we're there and we're, you know, we're doing as much as we can. We're only 11 people. We kind of split up in two different groups. And from there, we're basically patrol, like going house to house in the kibbutz because we're in the group chat with the civilians and they're texting us. I can hear Arabic at my house. They're shooting in my window. You can hear all these different things. And you're basically going someone on their phone looking at which house because we know the kibbutz. We know the kibbutz decently well at each house, each family. And we basically have to go on foot house to house and making sure that each...
Each family is okay. Okay.
Yeah. And I would say within a half hour, we go from 13, 14 people down to 6 people with 5 injured. So we had 5 people that were shot in the legs. And then as we go on, we did have like my... I'll tell a quick story about like my mafeked. So my mafeked that day, he was...
Your commander?
Yeah, my commander... Yakov Jabotinsky. He was one of the soldiers that fell that day. And like I'll give a great like a story about him, like how crazy his battle was. He was injured in his leg, and obviously because there's so many terrorists everywhere, we kind of had to split up into very small groups. And when we finally found where he was, I mean, he was he had 4 or 5 terrorists like where he was. It was him as he fell, and 4 or 5 people, like, that's, like, the odds that you're fighting. I mean, for each person, you have, like, 10 people that are shooting at you, so it was, like, insurmountable odds, like, I don't know, like, it's only from God, like, I don't know how most of my team made it out, but he was definitely someone, like, that really did save us, because, again, he's the commander, he's the person that really told you what you need to do. He was the one on the radio, he had most information, and because of that, he's also in the Israeli army. It's a big thing that the commanders are first. So the reason he was first to fall is because he's always the first to go where we need to go to how do you say this in English? Like to guide the line, or like guide the team, I guess you would say.
He leads the team. Like, yeah, he leads the team.
So obviously, if you're going to be the first to turn a corner or go into a house, like you have to be like the... The most the like heroic person, because you're gonna be the first. Wow. You know, it's the most dangerous. So he's like definitely someone's like one of my biggest heroes. Because without him, definitely I think it would have been a lot worse. I mean, without his like leadership and everything that he did. So.
Wow.
So yeah, but it was basically to sum up a quick story. It's not a quick story, but a long story. We're basically in this kibbutz, 12, 13 people, with half of us injured, and basically. I mean, having to drag them. You're basically you're one arm's with your gun, and your other arm's basically having to drag the other person because they can't walk.
How are you reacting when you're seeing half of your team who are your family shot in the leg and having to, you know, at the same time push off thousands of terrorists, and at the same time seeing your brother shot? Like, what? How are you feeling?
Something that you, like, even to this day, like, I comprehend it a little better, but it's something that, it's almost impossible to comprehend, like, the craziness, like, I remember looking, like, into the eyes of my friends who were injured, and I could see, like, they weren't scared, like, they weren't screaming, like, if I were shot, I think I would be, like, crying, like, freaking out.
I don't know.
You could, like, see them, like, how, like, they were still, like, they still had, like, injured, you couldn't walk, and what's the first thing they did is they pulled their pistol out, because they could only, or if they were shot in the arm, they had one arm, because they were ready to, like, they knew that we were the only people there, and these are civilians. These aren't this isn't an army base where people can fight for each other, for fight for themselves. These are civilians with with, I mean, we've met these people with children in their their
safe
house and everything. So you know, like, what you're really fighting for, and you know, like, if you don't do your job as until the end, like, more families are gonna be killed. So in the end, basically, we were there going house to house. We also later on finally were able to get to one of our armored vehicles and go around the kibbutz in an armored vehicle, which obviously helped a lot, for about 7 to 8 hours, from about 6:30 until 1:30 in the afternoon. And basically, we were there by ourselves for about 7-8 hours. I don't know. I mean, for what we did, obviously, we're not. I wish we could have saved everyone, but obviously, there was a lot of stories. I mean, there's, I think, about 5 people that were kidnapped and about another 4 or 5 that were killed in Nachoz. But when I really look back about what we did, I mean, Kfaza and Be'eri are like, you have to pass Nachoz to go to Kfaza and Be'eri, and I think almost half their village was either killed or kidnapped. So if you look at the difference, I mean, I feel like we did as well as we could. I mean, we didn't do, obviously, we couldn't save everyone as much as we wanted to, as much as we tried. And, you know, that's something that you carry with you every day, because you really, like, you, when I go back and visit, like, I feel, like, you always think about, even though you couldn't have done more, you always think about what could I have done differently, what could I have done more, but it's impossible to think of an answer, because, again, this is a, it's like an unattainable situation. It's impossible to really succeed. So the only thing you can do is really look at the people you were able to save. You can look, remember a really hard moment was going there a month afterwards, and we met with the people that lived, the village, the survivors there. And it was crazy because, I mean, on that day, it was like the day of death. Like, you only saw dead people. Everywhere you went, everyone was dead or hiding, so you didn't see them. So, like, when you finally meet the people that are living there, it was like, you know, you're going to, made me, definitely made me cry, but it's crazy because you put faces to, like, people in these houses. To the people you saved. And they tell you all these, like, stories about,
like, a different, like, perspective.
What they could, yeah, they could tell, like, oh, my friend in Kibbutz Be'eri, like, they had a totally different story than what they had, because, you know, we had a small forest in their kibbutz in Nachoz. So you can kind of see the differences between the different villages and their
perspectives,
and how grateful, I mean, it's amazing how grateful they are, what they've done for us. Like, I have even a family, there's an American, because I'm American, there's an American family in Nachoz that kind of, like, adopted me. I go over there and I visit their children, and like, I'm part of their family now because of it.
That's beautiful.
So, yeah.
I know you've probably heard this so many times, but what the work that you guys did was incredible. Yeah. Like, it's the courage, the bravery. It's insane.
Really, thank you. I mean, like, can't even begin to imagine.
Yeah. What that, no, like, was at the end of the day, I feel like it was amazing, but then it's our job, and that's what we're there to do. And we would do it a million times. We've talked about it, like, in group therapy. There's almost nothing we would change. We know, I know, like, my commander Yakov that fell on that day, I know he wouldn't change anything. I think he knew. Like, I know he knew what he was fighting for, and knew what he had to do, and he did it to the end. So I know, like, sorry, I'm mixing, like, a little emotional, but
of course.
I know that he would have no regrets. Like, the same way that everyone in my team has no regrets, I know that he would also have no regrets of what happened that day.
Wow. So, yeah. What a story.
Yeah.
Wow. Sorry, I could talk about it for days. I don't want to get into, like,
too far. Of course. Detail, it's this is, I mean, insane to think that you were.
If anyone wants to see more details, you can look. There's a lot. We've done some videos on. It's mostly in Hebrew though, and YouTube that go into low.
Can you say the name of the channel?
It's on Roots. It's 13, from what I believe.
Okay, channel 13 in Israel.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And then let's kind of push forward to segue to today.
Yeah.
You're now a student at Reichman University, and you do some reserve still.
Exactly.
What is life today looking like?
Yeah, life, I mean, I'll talk about after the war. So I got out of the army in January of 2024. So I was there for, 3 to 4 months of the war in my unit.
Inside of Gaza.
In and out, not too much, because again, we're a border police. We're the only, we did do some stuff, but we're not like the army. I'm not going there for a month at a time. You're going there for,
like, special missions and stuff.
Yeah,
like,
you're
that?
Not really, you're not going there and sleeping there for a month like a regular army. We're less about, our unit's less like kashur, like less about doing stuff like that, and more towards doing our specific jobs. But I got out in January, and from there, I mean, I didn't have a job. I didn't really have much to do. And I basically went straight to reserves. But the funny story with that is there's no reserves in my unit. So I didn't do it. So that's the story of how I transitioned to reserves in the Army.
And the best part about that is,
how do you find, if someone that doesn't have a unit in Milwim, how do you find a unit to do reserves in?
Please share.
So there's Telegram group chats. So all you do is go on Telegram.
What?
You literally send them a text on Telegram and you do like an interview with like the.
This is like sending your resume over?
Exactly. It's like sending a resume. You do like a quick interview.
Let me join you for
war.
Okay.
And they say, okay, come to Gaza. Come on.
Like, we need you. Let's
go. Yeah. So basically, because of my qualifications, I can basically go anywhere in reserves. I can do almost like any unit that's in the ground force. Obviously, I can't be like a. Even though how much I want
you
to
be a tank driver. Fighter pilot right now.
Yeah, I wish I could be like a tank driver or something, but obviously I need someone. If someone wants to train me on that, I'd be happy for free, though. I don't know
if anybody out here is listening.
training driver. For tank driver.
So from there, I basically told everyone, like, because all my friends were doing reserve, like, I felt like I had a very strong connection to the war, obviously, because, like, I was there for the first day. And then all my friends, you know, were in Gaza from end of November for like 3-4 months straight. I mean, until for most of the war, and I wasn't. So I kind of felt weird to say left out because I was only doing like little special missions.
No, it makes
a
lot of sense.
So I went straight into army unit in Shir Iron. That's why I say the tank driver joke, but I was in the Khir. I was in Parsa Esir, which is like the...
Shir Iron is the tank unit of the army.
But then they also have like a ground forces inside of Shir Iron that does like goes in with the tanks because... Tank can't go in by itself because it could get shot up. So they have to have...
And they're one of the first units that...
Yeah,
that
yeah. So they're right? Like the front of the front, basically. And they're crazy. A lot of guys on there, they're crazy dudes. So so I was with them for a few months in Gaza. Then I came out. And then from there, I came out. I got a job. Started working in as like a security guard in the Ritz-Carlton, which is
a
beautiful hotel, a very nice area right on the Marina of Herzliya.
You definitely did not leave the security life, did
you?
Yeah,
no. It's a very, very good job. And then after, you know, a month or two, I kind of got that feeling of like, oh, I'm so bored. So it's so weird to say, but I'm like, oh, I'm so bored in like civilian life.
So, you miss the army.
And the best thing too about the army is, I mean, I'm saying this now on a podcast, but I tell people it's Tzav Shmoni. Tzav Shmoni means the army telling you have to come back to Milwim, but I don't have Tzav Shmoni because I'm not in a
unit. You're not in the army.
Yeah, I have to request it. So like with my girlfriend, she found out I think about a month ago.
Oh my god! She found out you were requesting it.
I don't actually get called back to the army. I request.
You choose to be there.
I tell them that I want to go back, and then they tell me they accept me and let me go. So she thinks the whole time, you know, that, oh, he's going to stop, like, going to back
going
to army forcibly.
He's going to requested reserves. No, he's the one that's asking.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
exactly.
I need you guys.
I remember one day, because that's what I tell my family, that's what I told her. And I remember one day she told me, like, you know, near my birthday, you're not going to be in reserves. And I'm like, no, why would I be in reserves? I would have to request it. And she was like, what? What do you mean you have to request it? I was like, oh, no, I don't know what I'm talking
You're
about.
You're like, oh, I have no idea what I just got into.
But listen, it's amazing because that just goes to show from the beginning, since Arizona, the type of person you are.
Yeah,
the dedication is crazy. You lied to get in. You lied to stay in.
No, I'm not. It makes you sound like a liar, but
I'm not a liar. Just a dedicated
just
man.
A patriot.
Only the good lies, the good type of lies.
All right, well, there's this one last question that we ask every guest that we have on the podcast, which is if there's anything you could say to anyone listening to the podcast outside of Israel about the reality here, what would it be?
Yeah, no, I would say it's something that you always have hope. You know, as a situation like that, I feel like I've been in some hopeless situations, and I think you can really push through it. You can look at, for people outside of Israel, you can really look at the media and you can look and say, wow, everyone hates the Jews, everyone hates Israel, but it's not true. If you keep working, if we keep doing what we're doing, we can eventually reach enough people, and we can give everyone hope that, you know, it might take time, but I think the situation here is going to get better. I think we already can start feeling that it's better. We're having less rockets. Hopefully airlines come back soon. Hopefully travel goes back to normal. And I think just a big thing to just keep chugging along, like keep doing your thing, however you think that... specifically for people that want to help Israel, keep doing what you're doing. And eventually, even if you don't feel it now, you're going to make a difference. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not a week from now, but in a month from now, in a year from now, you're really going to see that difference. And it's something that you're going to look back on and be like so proud of yourself and be like, wow, I'm so happy I didn't just stop after a week or after a month, because now I can see what I really did. And it's like just to give you a bigger perspective on everything. Beautiful. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Cameron. And thank you guys for listening to the Beyond the Uniform podcast on Audioversity. I'm Rachel Escondri.
And I'm Rachel Safty. And we'll be back here with another episode telling one of the amazing untold stories of the beautiful heroes of Israel.
Beyond the Uniform. Stories of strength, resilience, and rising to the occasion. With Rachel Safty and Rachel Escondri.